Okay, let's go ahead and get started.
Just flip the wrong way.
So a couple of announcements. Homework number one is due today at 5 o'clock. You need to turn it in either after class in those boxes up there, or there's a box outside of 102 Steel. So this is not a big cardboard box sitting in the hall, but rather a box in the mail area. If you look, you'll see a bunch of big ABCD labeled boxes. I think F or something. Anyway, it says CDS 101 110 homework turn in. Open up the door, throw your homework in there. Okay? Please remember to put down the number of hours that you spent on the first homework set in the upper left corner of the back of the first page. The TAs use that, and I use that to make sure that we're getting the homeworks down, and we look at it both in the current year but also in the next year so we can say, oh, this is a hard set, or oh, this is an easy set, and move it in the right direction. So please do that for us. It helps provide us some feedback. Recitations will begin this week. You need to turn in your scheduling sheets today by 5 o'clock. We will then use those to figure out when we'll schedule the recitation sections at. We'll send an email out, post it on the web page. You can go to any section. We just want to make sure we get ones that actually fit people's schedules. Announced on Wednesday, the two course ombuds are Ashley and Dave, and you can talk to them about any problems. Dave, did he come in yet? Ashley's down here. Dave is going to walk in late again. He's a great ombuds because I think he gets his name called out a lot when he's not here. Homework number two is out. It's on the website. We will not hand out a hard copy version of it, so you need to go to the website and grab it. It's there already. There are six problems, but only four that you have to do. The first four. And there are two problems, five and six, that are in different application areas. And if you're comfortable with those application areas or it's an interesting problem, you're welcome to do either problem five or problem six in place of problem four. All right? But only turn in four problems, one, two, three, and either four or five or six. Okay. I think that's all the announcement things. Did I miss anything, Mary? I'll do the book in a second. Okay, so the other thing is on the book. A couple of people have asked me if you manage to find a typo in the book, I'd be amazed, but there are lots. So if you find typos, please give them to us. You are reading what is the final draft, but it still is a draft, of a book that will get sent to the publisher in April. And so we'd like to get as many of the comments as we can. So if you find a typo, send me an email about it. There's my email address, normal1. Anything that changes the meaning, it's not obvious. Now, if you find a technical error, you can make money, all right? So if you find an error in the math, not, a word problem or something, but an actual error in the math, if you're the first person to report it, I'll credit you a buck, up to $20 per chapter per person. So I'm pretty sure there aren't 20 math errors in any chapter, but I'm protecting my budget here. You need to send me not only this is wrong, but here's what's right. The first correct correction that I get, I will take that one. I will post those fixes to the wiki for the book so that you know that they're there. There's a spot, you can see it on the front page, where it talks about this version. We'll put them all there. So you probably want to check there first just to see whether somebody else has reported it. I can't do this instantaneously, so if it's there at the end of the day, then you might want to just send it, right, if you don't see it, and then I'll do the first one. And what I'll do is I'll keep track of it. I'll keep track of how much money did you make, and at the end I will give you a bundle of cash based on the total number of reported errors that you do. Okay? So if you're reading the book and you say, wait a minute, that derivation doesn't actually work, right? There's some problem there or something doesn't flow, figure it out. Send me an email. Make a buck. And if you find multiple ones of those, then great, right? And at the end, you can buy yourself dinner, okay? All right. So I can tell you that in the reading for homework number two, there is at least one such error, so there's a dollar sitting on the table ready for somebody to find it, okay? Because one of the TAs found it, and the TAs are immune from, the TAs are not allowed to submit these. You can submit them, but you don't get credit. Okay, also just a reminder that if you are struggling with the material or you'd like more examples or there's something that wasn't answered and for whatever reason it didn't go up on our own fact sheet, the book does have additional resources there. And so you can look at the exercises, the frequently asked questions, and other examples. And if you find an error on the wiki, also send an email on that. So those ones don't pay either. Okay? All right. So what I want to do today then is start into chapter 2. And so we'll start the actual technical material of the course. And the first topic in just about every controls course that you'll take is system modeling, because modeling is 95% of the job that you do when you're looking at a feedback system. So we'll define what a model is and how you use a model to answer different questions about a system. We'll introduce the notion of state, inputs, and outputs. And I'll give some examples of different types of modeling techniques. The reading is for CDS 101, sections 2.1 and 2.2, and section 3.1, and then for CDS 110, because we'll cover things on Wednesday, all of chapter 2, as well as section 3.1. For those of you for which this is review material, and sort of say, you know, you read the book and you go, yeah, I know all of this stuff, there is a very nice book written by Andrew Lewis, former PhD student here, that's a more mathematical approach to this, and chapter one of his book is a good description at a higher level of mathematical abstraction, the types of modeling that we do in systems and control. Right? So that's the plan for today. So let me just remind you what we did last week, which is we introduced the idea of feedback and control and talked about the fact that control is sensing, computation, and actuation in a feedback loop. And these two principles of control, robustness to uncertainty and design of dynamics, are kind of the fundamental things that we'll go through the entire course. And over the last week gave lots of examples of different application areas in which these ideas come up. So what we want to do now is to really start talking about modeling and analysis of feedback systems. And so what we're going to do in this course, as one does in most of engineering, is we're going to do our analysis and design based on models. So what does a model do for you? A model provides a prediction of how the system will behave. It tells me something without building the system about what I should expect to happen. When you have feedback systems, models are very important because you can get counterintuitive behavior. You change something expecting something to happen, but the feedback interactions make something different happen, and models help us sort out what's going on. And a really important thing about models in control systems, whether it's a natural control system or an engineered control system, is that the models can often be pretty approximate and still work well. In fact, what often amazes people is how much approximation you can do in a control setting and still get it to work. And the reason has to do with the fact that feedback provides the robustness to the modeling error. So the fact that you are modeling a feedback system means it's kind of robust with respect to uncertainty, including uncertainty in your own models. And so that's sort of the idea of why it is that even very simple models can work well in a feedback setting. Now, these statements, the top two especially, well, the top one about the use of models is true all over the place. When we talk about control systems, the thing that we add that you sometimes don't see other places is the notion of inputs and outputs. We think about models as having an input. That input causes something to happen, and I look at the output of what I can observe. And so in control-oriented models, inputs and outputs play a very central role, whereas in many other disciplines, inputs and outputs aren't quite as central. And an important point is that you can't really build a model until you know what question you're trying to answer. So if somebody says, give me a good model for this system, the very first thing you should say is, what question are you trying to answer? Because the question that you answer will affect the model that you choose to answer it. And a single system can have lots of different models depending on what question you're going to ask. And in particular, the time scale, and for systems with spatial scale, the spatial scale you use depends on those questions. And so if anyone ever says, please give me a model, and you don't know what question you're trying to answer, stop and ask, what question am I answering before you give the model? There's no universal model. So just as an example, a kind of simple example, if you're doing weather forecasting, and I say, give me a model that allows me to forecast the weather, that's not enough information. For example, the model that tells me what is it that's going to happen tomorrow, right? Is it going to rain today or tomorrow, is a model that takes into account a lot of what's happening locally near us and around. That may be very different than what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 days, where weather currents out in the ocean may make a bigger difference. Are we in an El Nino year? Other things. They probably don't affect as much the weather for tomorrow. I can look within, right, a couple of hundred miles of California or Pasadena and get a pretty good sense of what might happen tomorrow, what the local currents are. But if I want to know the next 5 to 10 days, I've got to start looking much more globally at what's happening around the planet. And of course, that's different yet if I want to ask, are we going to have a drought next summer? Right? Because looking at what the current weather patterns are probably isn't enough to tell me that. I need to look at, for example, something about what's going on around the globe, what are the different ocean temperatures and other things that affect the global climate. And so each of these three questions may have different models that go along with it. And so, for example, people who answer questions like this will use global circulation models that try and model the entire planet, whereas if you're just trying to model how much is going to rain tomorrow, you might have much simpler models that allow you to do that based on local measurements. And so this is just one of many examples, and I'll go through some other ones, where different questions can require different models. So models are used to answer questions. You need to know the question before you put together the model. All right, so let's look at some different types of models, and I'll start with one that we'll use as an example a couple of times over the course of the class, which is a spring mass system. So this system consists of two masses, M1 and M2, that are connected together by springs, and we have three springs here. We have a spring K1 that's connected to the ground, or to this sort of physical barrier, a spring K2 that's between mass 1 and mass 2, and a spring K3. And the idea is that I'm going to apply an input, some sort of a motion, to the end of this spring. And in this particular case, I also have a damper that's here. So this is the symbol for a damper. A damper is some sort of friction type of device. I'll write a model for it in a second. And this damper is intended to put in some level of force that impedes the motion. And here I've sort of also attached it to some central grounding system. And the questions I'd like to ask are, for example, how much do these two masses move? All right, so here's an example of a system that has that sort of a structure. What happens here is that I have the ground, I have a tire, I've got a mass that's the tire mass, so there's springiness in that tire. Right? I've also got some sort of a spring suspension system in the car itself, then I've got another mass, which is the mass of the car. Now, of course, this entire system actually has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 masses, and they're all coupled by springs. But if I do what's sometimes called a quarter car model, I just look at the front quarter of the car, for example, it looks similar to this. And it's not quite exactly the same. You have to decide where are these damping elements and other things. But it's an example where you have multiple spring elements that are pushing on your system. And the question you would like to ask is, how much do my tires move up and down? Call that the tires. How much does my actual mass move up and down? And here, this connection to ground is actually gravity in this particular case, so the fact that you're getting pulled down rather than a springiness. But I can ask how much, if I move the road up and down, that means that I'm going over a bumpy road, how much do my tires bounce up and down, and how much does my body bounce up and down if I'm sitting inside this car? So this type of system comes up in flexible structures, it comes up in suspension systems, it actually comes up in molecular systems as you look at is forces that are interacting between molecules. So these spring mass systems come up in a number of different applications. And we can ask, again, how much do the masses move? We can also ask, what happens if I change the values of the masses? Is it good or bad to put more mass into the tires or not? Can I, for example, ask a question if we're doing this for Bob, which was our original Grand Challenge vehicle, or Alice, can I tell you something about whether or not Bob is going to fly into the air if I hit a bump at a certain size? Just a little story. When we first designed Bob, we were worried about the tires going flat, and so we actually got foam-filled tires, which is what they use for like forest trucks and things like that to keep them from popping. Problem with foam-filled tires, very heavy, a couple of pounds, 100 pounds a piece. All right, problem with that? Going over big roads, tires want to stay on the ground, right? So your vehicle goes up, your tires stay on the ground. You really stretch stuff up. I mean, in fact, we bent part of our suspension system by putting these heavy tires on it. If we used a model, we could have seen, oh boy, if I go over certain bumps, right, I'm going to get a lot of excursion between these two things. We shouldn't do that. Unfortunately, we put them on there and found it out the hard way. Okay, so we're going to model this system. We'll assume that the mass, spring, and damper constants here are known, and I'll write down the laws for them in a second. The springs will be satisfying Hooke's law, that is, the force is proportional to the distance of extension of the spring. We'll assume that the damper is linear, that is, that the force it applies is proportional to the velocity of the damper. All right? So not quite like a shock absorber, a damp shock absorber, but somewhat similar. Those tend to be more quadratic, but that's the models. And just to sort of show you the type of system that you might want to do an analysis for and see what's going to happen. Here's one. All right, this is this system. And you kind of see those tires bouncing up and down, but the body not bouncing up and down very much. Here's another view. And you see here the motion of the vehicle is relatively smooth compared to these tires that are just bouncing up and down like crazy. Right? And that's what you sort of want, right? You want an isolated system so that the tires are bouncing up and down like crazy, but your vehicle is not going at that same bouncing up and down, right? Especially if you're driving it. So that's the sort of system that we'd like to look at. Okay, so how are we going to model this? So we're going to model this using ordinary differential equations. So we're going to write down what are the physics of the model that we care about. So this is basically just physics one. So the sum of the forces is going to tell us what happens at any individual point. So the sum of the forces applied to a mass is going to determine the acceleration by F equals ma. Hooke's law says that the force applied by the springs is some constant times the motion of that spring minus its rest position. So here, x, sorry, I should have written q. So Q1 is the extension of the first spring. Q2 is the location of the second mass, which means that Q2 minus Q1 is the extension of this spring. Those have some rest length, and the difference between the actual length and the rest length will be proportional to the force. And finally, viscous friction. The force applied is just B, a constant of viscous damping, times the velocity V. Right. So that's sort of the physics that describes it. We can now write down F equals ma, and here we'll write it as ma equals F. So the mass 1 times the acceleration of this mass is equal to the forces applied to it. What are the forces applied to it? Well, we have a force from this spring, which is given by k2 times the relative displacement between q2 and q1, and then we have a force from this spring, which is just the displacement given by q1. And here I've subtracted out already the rest length, so in fact, if it's in its nominal position, we would call this Q1 equals 0, Q2 equals 0 when it's in its rest configuration. Right? I'm just subtracting them. Similarly, for the second mass, we can look at all the forces. There's basically the two springs plus the damper, and the damper is just the velocity of Q2, so however fast this mass is moving back and forth. So those ordinary differential equations describe the system. In this class, we will usually not deal with systems that are in this form directly. Oh, and the input over here is going to be this motion of U right there. Right? That's my input. I move that position. So we will normally write these in a slightly different form, which is called state-space form. And the idea in state-space form is we want to make a vector of variables that describe the evolution of the state, that allow us to describe the evolution of the state. And so when we've done that, we will rewrite the system in this form. dx by dt, the time derivative of x, is equal to some function f of xu, where x is a vector of states, u is a potential vector of inputs, and then we'll have some output that we measure or that we care about modeling, which we'll take to be a function of the states, and we might have some vector of those. So n is the number of states, p is the number of inputs, q is the number of outputs, and we think of x as a column vector that describes that. And so here I have my model of my physics. I'd like to convert it into this form. And so we do that by simply rewriting the equations. We call the vector x the variables that are needed to describe the evolution. For a system of this sort, I need to know the displacement of the masses, Q1 and Q2, plus their velocities. If I know Q1 and Q2, then I can figure out how those evolve. I can figure out the derivative of those as a function of time, how they change as a function of time. And so if I write down d by dt of Q1, Q2, Q1 dot, Q2 dot, then d by dt of Q1 dot is just Q1 dot. That's one of my states. D by dt of Q2 dot is Q2 dot. D by dt of Q1 dot is Q1 double dot, right? The derivative of the velocity is acceleration. I can read off the acceleration from here, and so I just write this down here. So this is the same. I just divided by m. Same thing down here. I just divided by this m. This should be m1. This should be m2 that I'm dividing by. And my output in this case, since I care about how much do the tires move and how much does the body move, is Q1, Q2. Right? So whenever you see a model like this or written out more explicitly like this, we'll call it in state-space form. And so on your homework, if I say write a state-space model for this system, I want to know what's x, what's u, what's y, and I want it written down in this form. That's the idea. All right. Questions on what I mean when I say a state-space model? The vector state? Okay. Yeah, sorry. You mean like which order and things?
No, like the box or the non-box.
They're the same in the sense that if I think of x as a vector, right? Here I've just written it out explicitly. So if you were to write out what f of xu is, it's the column vector here, right? The first element of f is q1 dot. The second element is q2 dot.
So it saves both of us time.
If you write this out, you're going to end up writing this. If I give you a specific system.
But I mean on the homeworks and stuff.
Yeah, on the homeworks, effectively, you'll end up writing in this form. I mean, you can say this is f of x u, this is x, but that's, this is the detail we need. Okay? Other questions? Okay. All right, so how do we then use a model like this to do something interesting? And in the particular case of the spring mass system, how do we use it to figure out how much the masses move? And one of the things that we can do is we can talk about the steady state response. And so the way we think about the steady state response is that I take the end of this system here and I force it with a sinusoid. I move it back and forth at a fixed frequency. And I wait until the system settles into a regular pattern. So for many systems and for all linear systems, if I force a system, and we'll sort of show this in detail later, if I force a system at a given frequency, the system state will oscillate at that same forcing frequency, and I need to wait until any transients have died out and other things, and it kind of settles into a regular pattern. And then what I can do is I can plot out what is the steady state response, and in particular I can plot out the relative magnitude and phase of the output versus input. So I'll describe this in more detail in a second, but here's the idea. Suppose that I have the blue mass and the green mass, and I move this back and forth 1 inch. Then I can ask, how many inches does the green mass move and how much does the blue mass move? And if I take the model that I just described and I put in those forcing frequencies and I wait for some period of time, I in fact get out this response. And what that response looks like is, at low frequencies, this is in radians per second, the green mass moves, if you look at this, I've written it in a poor way, this is zeros up here, this is slightly less than one in magnitude, so meaning that the green mass is moving less than the amount I'm forcing it, so it's attenuating a little bit, and the blue mass is actually moving less than that. All right, so I've used a notation that I'm trying to avoid, and in the book we avoid it very well, but since I've got it up on this thing, you will sometimes see this notion of dB. The way to think about dB is if the ratio of input over output, if I take that magnitude, so I look at the input magnitude, 1 inch, all right, I look at the output magnitude, I divide it by the input magnitude, that gives me a pure number. I then take the logarithm of that base 10 and multiply it by 20. This gives me units of dB. All right. So what does that mean? It means that 20 dB is equal to 10 minus 20 dB is equal to 0.1, et cetera. Right? 40 dB is 100. 0 dB is 1. Minus 40 dB is 0.01. So if something is less than 0 dB, then the ratio of the magnitude of the output to the input is less than 1. So for example, here, 0 is right above, it's the tick mark right above that green line, so it says that at low frequency, the motion of this point here, the motion of M1 and M2 are both smaller than my input. As I go up to higher frequency, and in particular as I get to this frequency, now this is up getting close to 20 dB. It's at about 15 dB. Let's suppose it was 20. That says that if I move the input 1 inch, both of those masses move 10 inches. Right? So I'm getting amplification. There's a resonance there, right? I'm hitting it at some resonance, and I'm getting everything to really shake. Similarly here, I'm getting something at a high resonance. Here you get an interesting phenomena, which is that here one of the masses is vibrating, but the other mass is not vibrating very much. It's at 20 minus 20 dB or so, which means that it's only vibrating a tenth as much as the input. So what's happening is one mass is moving and the other one isn't. And in fact, if you look at the colors, this mass is not moving and this one is. So it's a kind of an interesting situation. This is moving back and forth. This is barely moving at all. And this thing's moving back and forth a fair bit. Right? So you can get these weird resonances. So looking at this, you could then tell me something about if, for example, I was going to get road noise down at this frequency, it attenuates it, but if I was going to hit washboards right here, I might shake myself out of the seat because my body is going to move 10 times as much as the washboards, which are maybe 6 inches high, right? So now that's 60 inches worth of stuff, right? That's 5 feet, right? That's not good, right? So you want to be careful about resonances like this, and this model allows us to do that. So how do we figure out this curve from the equations I wrote down? Well, you use MATLAB, all right? And in fact, this curve was plotted, if you look on the back of the handout, the last page of the handout, can I see it? Is this the next one? Right, so if you look at the very back, right, you see the code that I used to generate that plot. And in fact, let me just make sure. Yep. So what I did was essentially I showed you how do you use MATLAB to simulate this system and extract out the frequency response. I put in a sinusoid at a certain frequency, wait until it settles, and extract out the magnitude and phase. So that's what's used to get this plot. And the way you do that in MATLAB, and this is what's in that printout, is that you define a function in MATLAB that is the function, the state space function you want to simulate. Now, the way that they do it is they use, well, for whatever reason, they use the symbol Y here. Y is the state, not the output. Sorry, that's my bad. Dy by dt is x dot. So x dot is x3, that's the third state, x4, the fourth state, and then this equation. And of course, this is exactly the previous equation that I had. Right? That is, that equation. Right? So the third state is Q1 dot, the fourth state is Q2 dot, right? The next two are funny combinations of those things. So that's the MATLAB description of that. And then what you do is you call a function called ODE45, ordinary differential equation. It's a Runge-Kutta 45, that's why it's called 45. You pass it this function that you want to simulate, you pass it the time you want it to run over, and you pass it whatever parameters, and here I've defined some input that I want to use, and it will simulate that for you and tell you what the output was. All right. So that's the way we use this model to do a simulation. Oh, yep, sorry. So in the handout, it's correct, right? In the MATLAB code on the back of the page. Did I get it right there? There should be spring mass, which is on the right-hand side, which is the function.
Yes, that's
okay, so Mary's right. We need to fix this. This should have been F, not dy by dt. It should have been F. At F. Okay? So change that to at F, but you have the code. Just I'll say now, the MATLAB code that's on the back printout, and this will always be true, if I ever give you a printout of MATLAB code, the actual MATLAB code is sitting on the web server. All right, so you can go to the wiki and you can just get the MATLAB code. So if you want to try this out and run that script and see what happens, the MATLAB code is there. Okay, so that's the idea of how we might use a model to figure out the frequency response and answer the question, how much do the tires and the body move as a function of different frequencies of disturbances that I'm seeing from the road? And that plot is essentially the answer to that question. It doesn't tell me, in detail what are the stresses on the different struts in there. It doesn't tell me a lot of other things that you might care about. What is the role of the vehicle? Am I slipping? Right? Lots of other things you might care about when you're driving. That wasn't the question that I wanted to answer. I just wanted to answer what was the motion of the tires versus the motion of the body as a function of the forcing coming from the road. And that's the typical thing you need to just make sure you know what question you're answering. Okay, so we'll use a couple of different pieces of terminology. And so I want to just go through some examples. The state is one. So the state of a system is the set of independent physical quantities that determine the future evolution of the system. So what do I have to know about the system in order to be able to predict what happens next? Normally, you figure out the state by trying to write down a set of equations. If you write down how those evolve in time and you start using other variables that didn't appear, you got to include them in the state as well. Right? So you need to get enough variables that everything is determined by the differential equations. The inputs to a system describe the external excitation. These are things coming from the outside, the road, or if you've got something where you're looking at a biological system, that might be different temperatures or pH levels coming from the environment. If you're looking at an electrical system, that might be electrical noise, or it might be the signal coming from your MP3 player before it goes into your amplifier. If you're monitoring the amplifier, the signal coming in is an input to that system. So this is something that is external to the system that you're trying to model. The dynamics of the system describe how the state evolves. It's basically an update rule for the system state. We'll often use differential equations. That is, what's the velocity of the state as a function of the current state. And the dynamics have to depend on the current state and the external inputs. And finally, the outputs are the things that I measure. They are a function of the state in the inputs, so they're not independent variables. They are a function of things that I've already defined, and they're often a subset of the state. And so I may have For example, the masses in the spring mass, I didn't choose the velocities of the masses. I only chose their positions, right? Even though, as my outputs, even though my state was the positions and the velocities, right? So they're often a subset of that. And if you're just doing modeling for the first time, you know, the difference between states and outputs is often a little bit confusing, and how do you choose the states? In the end, what you need is the set of physical quantities that allow you to determine the future, and you start writing those down and seeing whether that's enough. So, for example, in the spring mass system, the state is the positions and velocities of each of the masses. So Q1, Q2, Q1 dot, and Q2 dot. I need these in order to write down how those evolve. The inputs, in this case, is the position of the end here that I'm setting externally in some way, the modeling of the road in the example. The dynamics are the basic mechanics, Hooke's laws, viscous friction. And the output is the measured positions of masses 1 and masses 2. All right. Okay, so that's the terminology we'll use, and whenever you define a model, you should do that. One thing to point out is that the choice of state is not unique. So there might be several different variables that you could use. An easy version of that is that I might choose different scales. I might measure in inches, I might measure in meters. To some extent, those are different states. I mean, it's obviously just a unit change, but I get different numbers in there. A little bit less trivial is, and this isn't on your homework, it's on a previous homework, is that I might use, instead of, for example, looking at the position of Q1, the position of mass 1 and the position of mass 2, I might look at the position of mass 1 relative to this side over the left side, and the position of mass 2 relative to mass 1. Right? That would be a different choice of state. That would be Q1 and whatever this distance was, call it Z1, right? Or Z2. Right? I mean, so it would be a different choice of state. So it's not a unique choice, and if you're doing modeling, you get to decide what your state is. The choice of the inputs and outputs come about really as you start modeling a system, and I'll show you some examples of this in a bit, but think of the inputs as the things that are external to the model that I'm building. To some extent, I can always make my box bigger around what I'm looking at and think of things that used to be inputs as states. I could model the road as part of my state, for example. But normally, there's a natural decomposition of the road is something external to the car because it's the car that I'm designing, and I don't know ahead of time what road you're going to be driving over and other things, so I'll model that as an input. And as we start to interconnect systems in feedback, then, of course, the inputs to one model are probably the outputs from another model, and so if you're interconnecting things, you might have outputs in one model be inputs to the other, so you need to keep track of those. And generally, the outputs are the physical variables that you can actually measure. So the state is the physical variables that are required to determine the future evolution. The output are the states are the physical variables that you actually measure. And in addition to having different choices of state and choices that you have to make about inputs and outputs, you can also have different types of models. Again, just coming back, for example, to this weather model where we might have different levels of modeling depending on the question we want to answer. So, for example, for rigid bodies like the spring mass system or coupled rigid bodies, you might use differential equations. We might use finite state machines as a different way of modeling different types of systems or partial differential equations. And sometimes the same system can have different types of models used for the same system. So for in weather, for example, sometimes you use ordinary differential equations to predict the weather for tomorrow, and partial differential equations could also predict the weather for tomorrow. So if you know about different types of modeling, then you can apply the same different types of models to the same system and different types of models to different systems. We will primarily in this class use ordinary differential equations and difference equations, which I'll define in a minute, but there's lots of control work in finite state machines and partial differential equations, and so if you're modeling those systems, you can go out and find the equivalent things. Okay, so as I already said, most of what we'll do will be differential equations, which we've already talked about, of this form. So in a differential equation, we describe the rate of change of the state variables. We look at both the state and time as continuous variables. That is, we think of the state as something that is a real number. It can take on any value. We think of time as another real number, like time. And we can write down, then, how the state evolves as a function of time. And so there are tons of examples. The book has tons of examples. Here's one that's not in the book, which is the power grid. So here are the equations that are used to describe how power plants interconnect to one another. So what we have here are we have two generators. We use the rotor angle on the generator as the one of the state variables for a generator, and the velocity of that rotor angle, the speed of the generator, is the second. And then if I have two generators, then I write down the dynamics for one generator and the dynamics for the other generator, and this describes how they're coupled. So notice that delta 1 double dot, the angular acceleration of generator number 1, depends on its own speed through some damping, that's what this term is, but also depends on the phase of generator 2, right, through these two terms. And so this is the fact that they're connected together electrically, and if they're out of phase electrically, then they will actually generate currents that will eventually generate forces through the generating system, through all of the coils. So the swing equations, if you want to simulate the power grid and understand how do all of these generators couple together, are what you would use to do that. And the stability of these equations is what you use to make sure that when somebody switches on a large load, that the power grid responds properly and all the generators add a little bit more fuel to kind of couple that. If they did it wrong, they'd all start cycling between each other, generators slowing up and speeding down. That's what generally leads to a blackout, so you don't want that to happen. Okay, so for this system, what's the state? In this particular system, here are the equations. So if I have delta 1, delta 2, delta 1 dot, and delta 2 dot, I can figure out what the derivatives of delta 1 dot, delta 2 dot are, and that will tell me what they are for the next phase. So generally, when you see a set of equations in this form, it is the variables plus their derivatives up to the next to the highest order that form the state. So here I have a second order derivative. That's what that means. And so I need delta 1 and delta 1 dot. If I had a third order derivative, I'd need delta 1, delta 1 dot, delta 1 double dot in order to describe the state. So here the state is just the rotor angles and velocities. The inputs here are the power loading from the power grid. So this term here is actually how much power is being drawn off of these generators. That's the input because I don't determine that, right? That's outside my system that I'm trying to understand. The outputs in this particular case are the voltage levels and frequency, right? Do I get 60 hertz at 120 volts? That's the output from a generator, and that is actually based on the rotor speed. Right? So the 60 hertz is based on this thing spinning at 60 hertz. And the voltage levels, because of the way the generators are built up, also depend on the speed of the rotors. And so the voltage levels and frequency are based on the rotor speed. The rotor speed is part of the state, and so the output depends on the states. Okay, so there's an example using differential equations. Here's an example of a finite state machine. So a finite state machine is models discrete transitions between a finite number of states. It's almost the opposite extreme of an ODE where we had continuous states and continuous time. Here what happens is we represent each configuration of the system as a state and we model the transitions between those states using a graph. So example, traffic light. Right? So if I want a model of a traffic light, how might I do that? Well, one simple model might be to say, I have a state where the north-south traffic is allowed to go green. When the north-south traffic light is green, then a timer starts as soon as it goes green. When that timer gets to 30 seconds or however that light stays on, then I turn the traffic in the other direction, right, to the east and west. There's probably a yellow light in here, but right, we're doing a simplified model. Now I keep it east and west until some car arrives, right? I mean, there's no point in changing it. When a car arrives on the north-south street, then at that point, I turn a timer on and say, okay, I'm going to trigger it. 30 seconds later, I'm going to change it. So I now move to a new state where a timer is running. In that new state, when the timer expires, then I change it and I go to north-south. I stay in north-south until a car arrives, and then I do the same thing in the east-west direction. All right? So there's an example. What's the state of this system? In order to know what happens next, I need to know, am I in this position, this state, this state, this state, this state? There are four discrete states to the system. One, two, three, four. Right? Which mode am I in? What is the way that I describe what happens next? It's these arrows connecting these things together. It's the transition from one state to another. Very different type of model. But nonetheless, I can ask similar questions. How long will it take before something changes? Is, you know, how long do I do a transition? What happens if one car comes up and then another car comes up? I can look at this model and try and reason about what's the traffic flow pattern through this. Okay, so in this case, The state is the current pattern of lights that are on plus the internal timers. That basically tells me which box I'm in. The inputs are the presence of a car at an intersection. That's an external input that controls the transition between one state and another. And the outputs are what is the actual traffic light telling me to do. And again, you could make this more complicated. There's actually an exercise that we've used in the past that's on the book wiki, writing a little simulation for this. So if you're enamored of finite state machines, please go do that. Okay, another type of model is a difference equation. We'll actually use difference equations a fair bit in this class. So a difference equation is kind of in the middle. The idea in a difference equation is that you have discrete transitions in time between continuous variables. So the discrete time part of the description is that I'm going to think about having a clock. So every tenth of a second, something's going to happen. The state's going to get updated, or every hundredth of a second. But what happens is going to be modeled by a state that is a continuous variable. So we have a continuous variable for the state, but a discrete time aspect. So an example of that is, if you go look at, this is the inside guts of a CD read-write head controller, like your DVD controller on your laptop, and inside this is a digital signal processor. What the digital signal processor does is, every 44,000 times a second, so every 1 over 44,000 hertz, I read what the track location is off of the read head. So I read the read head, I see what the signal looks like. I read off whatever the data is from that, right? What's the bit that's underneath that right now? But I also locate the track center. And so you have a track that's spinning on a disk, and if I move off of that track, the signal starts to degrade. I can detect that degradation, so I can tell where am I. Am I to the left or right of center? So once I've done that, I can estimate where the wobble on the disk is. Those things don't land quite right, and I can use that estimate of how am I wobbling back and forth to move the disk head so that it's ready for where the track is going to be next. And so if I take a little CD player, I put it in my laptop, it's wobbling a little bit because it's not perfectly centered, but my computer is every 44,000 times a second, it's looking to see which way is it wobbling and figuring out how do I position the read head just right. That's what lets you get the density, by the way, on DVDs, is tight feedback control of tracking that wobble. So there's a feedback controller in everybody's laptop that's doing that. It's why you can be reading a DVD, right, and moving around a little bit and it still works, right? Because as you move around, you get external disturbances. Yeah, question. So it reads more than one track at once, and so it can actually tell multiple things. Depends, actually. Lots of different schemes you can use for encoding and, you know, different things that they've optimized, but that's the easy way. Okay, so here what you want to do is you want to keep the disk track centered, and you want to reject any disturbances due to warped disks, shaking, bumps, etc. So that's the control design problem. And so it's an example of something where now, because you've got this controller that's running at a finite frequency, we think of it as discrete time. We'll usually model that with an equation that looks like this. So we'll think of x, the state, at time k, and x at time k plus 1, the next increment of time, is a function of the x at the current time plus the input at the current time. Okay, so here, the state estimated center and wobble, the inputs are the read head signal, the outputs are the command in motion. Here's another example from a totally different arena. This is a predator-prey system. So I was actually in Canada where this ecosystem lives just a while ago. So this is a snowshoe hare, I think, and that's a lynx. And this was a snowshoe hare, I suppose. It looks like it's about to get caught. Okay, so there's this interesting ecosystem up in the Canadian Rockies where for 100 years or so, they tracked the number of snowshoe hares and the number of lynxes. And so the hares are here in the green line, and the lynxes are in the dashed line. And the question was, why are these populations oscillating so much? And so we wanted to answer that question. Is this something that has to do with external environmental things? Is it just because, you know, the foxes eat all of the hares and then they start to die out, and then the foxes don't have anything to eat, so they die out? You know, what's that interaction? So we'd like to say, in particular, given the current population of rabbits and foxes, what's it going to be next year? If I hunt down all the foxes, am I going to get better or worse? Right? If I kill all the foxes, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And how, if I change over the long term, the food that's available, I either put out food or I, you know, destroy habitat and get rid of food, how is that going to affect this particular ecosystem? So we have some modeling assumptions that are here that we put in about the way that we model it, but the idea is to try and write down the description of the physics of this system, the biology of this system. And one way to do that is with something called the discrete Lotka-Volterra model. where we think of the state of the system as at a time K, what year is it, what month is it, let's say. So if we do it on a month-by-month basis, we're going to track that. On month number one, month number two, etc., I look at the number of rabbits, the number of foxes. I look at the amount of rabbit food that's available. My outputs are the total number of rabbits and foxes. And here are some update equations. I say the number of rabbits depends on the number of rabbits I had in the previous period, plus some birth rate of the rabbits, which depends on how much food they have, minus some death rate of the rabbits, where the death rate of the rabbits depends on the product of the number of rabbits and the number of foxes. So if you have more rabbits, more of them will get picked off. If you have more foxes, more rabbits will get picked off. Similarly, the number of foxes depends on the number of foxes from the previous period, minus some death rate of the foxes, plus growth rate of the foxes, which depends on the number of rabbits they can eat. All right? So there's a simple model put together to describe this system. And I have a bunch of inputs and functions. So DF is a parameter, A is a parameter, this BR is some function of the amount of food. And if you take that model and put together a simulation, I think this is also in the handout, so it should be on the bottom half of the left column, you can take this model, plug in numbers that are listed there, and you'll get this sort of a simulation for that. And if you actually go and compare that simulation to reality, you see it's not too bad, right? I mean, it's not exact. This says, for example, that the number of rabbits and foxes are different, but we've at least captured the oscillation, and we've actually captured the period of oscillation. So now we can go and ask, what would happen if I increased the amount of food that the rabbits had? What would happen if I went and I suddenly changed the number of foxes, right? I can use this model to answer those questions. Obviously, it's an approximation, so it may not give me exactly the number of foxes, but it will allow me to at least do something, right, that's different than just going and, you know, chopping down a bunch of trees and saying, gee, I wonder what will happen, right? I can at least try and put that into the model. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's examples in the book, but one of the things that models like this get used for is fisheries management, right? So if what you want to do is make sure that if we're fishing the oceans, right, we know that we're extracting fish out of the ocean at some rate, you're getting paid for that, but you don't want to do something where all of a sudden you have no fish left and your entire industry goes bankrupt, right? You'd like to make sure you're fishing at a sustainable rate. So they actually use these sorts of population models to try and do fisheries management. So there's an example of this. Okay, so I've shown you a couple of different examples of types of modeling. In this class, a model will mean thinking about what the state, inputs, outputs, and dynamics are of a system. We can either do that in continuous time using differential equations or in discrete time using what are called difference equations. And remember that the choice of the model depends on what questions you want to ask. And so we sort of looked at a couple of different models and how to write those down. In your homework, you'll do more. On Wednesday, what we'll do is that we will dig into, on your homework, you'll look at solutions of differential equations and build up some simulation models using MATLAB and Simulink, everybody's favorite two tools. You will do some difference equation work. On Wednesday, we'll kind of dive into the state-space modeling details and properties of ODEs. On Friday, we'll have a tutorial. So if you kind of feel like you're getting lost and you get to Wednesday and you go, boy, I don't really remember that stuff, the tutorial is for you. The tutorial is designed to remind you of things from ODEs and linear algebra that we assume you know. Mary will give that, and then next week we'll start using that understanding to look at stability and performance. Okay, that's it.